For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning. For Hatsu Sesshin Dragons, everyone is here as part of our Rohatsu, even if you just showed up. Kind of like, you know, taking a cab to the end of the marathon, but you get a prize anyway, or at least a Dharma talk. And let's see, I want to welcome Ian, who I think is relatively new here, and Mayor, who was here maybe before, and everyone else who's been here, who will be here, we're here. So this is the fifth day of the concluding day of our Rohatsu Sesshin, which a bunch of us have been sitting here in this zendo from morning till evening, honoring, paying homage to the awakening of Shakyamuni Buddha. And we've been following Buddha's path from being a little baby, there's baby Buddha on that altar, to we're almost getting to the end of this story, Buddha's awakening. And also Eve, I think you're here for the first time at this sesshin. Yeah. Okay. So, cliff notes. I don't even know if people use those. Do students even use those? Do you know what those are? Yeah, okay. I never used them, but I saw them, and I'm like, why didn't I think of that earlier, you know? But this is kind of the short version, speed version of what we've been coursing through and in, and stories we've been telling during this five-day meditation intensive. I don't even want to call it a retreat, intensive engagement with life, with each other. This covers the first 35 years of Buddha's life. So from birth to about, let's say, 35-ish years when he awakened. So, you know, had a little ground to cover. We've covered Buddha's miraculous conception, the elephant, white tusked elephant, six tusker, going into the side of Queen Maya. That was her dream, that this, she was pregnant. Many people who get pregnant have dreams, you know. So this was a white elephant, considered to be an auspicious sign. Then Buddha, like any human, was born, at least as far as I know, from the womb of his mother. In a beautiful grove of trees, pops out. Tree extends the branch to support Maya, the queen, and out pops this fully formed, walking and talking infant. Kind of amazing, right? But that's how all these old stories are. Kind of amazing. And this tree branch and this tree, which had a tree spirit associated with it, has been a theme of our event, our sesshin together, for this past 5 days. The theme of trees, our connection and relationship to trees, their support and protection. Trees as a bridge between earth and sky. We even had the mysterious, auspicious arrival of Sei Tetsu, who showed up here for this sesshin sort of unexpectedly in some ways. I think I, you know, you talked about coming, but then you had planned to do something else, and then you weren't going to come. And I said, are you coming? And you said, yeah, okay, I will.
Got in her car and came here.
Drove from Boston.
Oh, wow.
And Seitetsu is someone I practice with in the Zen Center of North Shore Sangha, which are really good friends of ours. And maybe someday their teacher, Joan Amaral, will grace us with her wonderful presence. But the reason I bring up Seitetsu, not just because she traveled so far to get here, but she's just come here after offering to the city of Boston an installation called A Future Monument to the Trees of the Public Garden. And this is a public garden in Boston, and there are odes to trees. And we'll post a link probably in the newsletter, maybe on our website, to this, to the documentation of this installation, the website. So we have these trees coming to us. We have our own trees here outside of the Lincoln Square Zendo, our linden trees and a yew tree that I can see the branches of out of this window, supporting us in our awakening. And our bodhisattva practice is also an ode to trees, I would say, and to this world. And the baby Buddha on an altar standing on top of a lotus is almost a tree themselves, pointing to the ground and to the sky, connecting the earth and sky. So these trees are this bridge. We are trees sitting upright in samadhi. So that's the theme, the tree theme. Someone recently confessed being, I think, a tree hugger in this room. Soon after baby Buddha arrived, also known as the Bodhisattva, before attaining, you know, complete awakening, pops out of the side of his mom, the queen, and takes seven steps in a bunch of directions. But each time a step happens, a lotus flower comes out of the muddy water, you know, to support the foot of Buddha. So already, you know, these lotuses are also another theme. We're sitting on our lotus seats. The lotuses are supporting us when we're walking Kinhin, our walking meditation. And also, we are deeply, our awakening is deeply rooted in the mud of our lives, which we've touched on just a little. Another theme offered to us by Howard, who's with us, is audacity. You know how audacious this infant Buddha stood up confidently and declared, I alone am the world-honored one. It's a little sassy, a little audacious. But to even sit, we have to have some kind of audacity. You know, a little impudence, maybe, to actually do this practice, to take our lives seriously enough, even though we know we don't know anything, to actually explore that not knowing. It's pretty audacious. So that's another theme, is this audacity of claiming our place in this world, our own responsibility for our own practice, and also trusting our confidence in the kind of awakened wisdom and Buddha nature that runs, the energy that courses through everything. So continuing on with this little infant grows up, maybe kind of forgets their place in the world after speaking. I don't know if they had to relearn to speak after saying those, you know, I alone and the world honored one. But whatever happened, this bodhisattva was born into privilege and indulgence in a palace so they say, in a compound, a family compound, and became an adolescent. So this adolescent bodhisattva became curious about life outside of the compound, outside of the palace, and snuck out. If anybody ever did that, you know, sneak out of the house. If you haven't, try it. You're all actually sneaking out of the house by coming here. You're leaving home in some ways just by being here on a Sunday morning, getting up so early. And being a child of privilege and wealth, had a personal attendant and driver that took him on a little tour. And I don't know what, if Buddha, this bodhisattva, Siddhartha, had some idea about what they were going to find outside the palace, but they seemed shocked by what they saw. They woke up to reality, and this kind of triggered or engendered a spiritual crisis by seeing three sights, really, four sights maybe, was part of the fourth, might have been part of the trigger too. But there was a shock and disillusionment when Siddhartha, driving around, maybe got out of the chariot and walked down the street and saw a very sick person, sickness, writhing on the ground, old age, decrepit, wrinkly old person. None of us have any of those features, you know. It's kind of funny to be at least my age, 65, and shocked by the sight of your own skin. Like, that's not mine, right? So it's wrinkles, you know, crepiness. But imagine this young person going, I never saw that before, you know, so shielded, you know. Maybe there was a lot of the equivalent of plastic surgery going on in that palace compound, but, you know, this kind of forestalling of the inevitable and hiding your child from that. You know, we want to protect our children, but sometimes it's a little too much. And they find out anyway, no matter how much we love them and want to shield them, they find out. Hopefully not too early, and hopefully with a lot of love and support around them. But this created this sense of urgency of like, oh my God, you know, what life is, I'm subjected to this. So yeah, the driver, you know, the attendant, probably a slave, you know, of course, educates the privileged person. We've never heard this before. But apparently it's a time-honored, horrible tradition. But the charioteer is like, yeah, that's an old person, and you're going to get old too. Guess what? Well, the sick person goes, you know, your body is subject to that. Sickness is inevitable. And the corpse, seeing a corpse being taken to the, I don't know, ghat, the place that they burn bodies, or the charnel ground, that too is your fate. So this young person was understandably upset, but also like really like going, uh-oh, business as usual is not working for me. I'm overwhelmed, anxious. I want to figure out what to do about this. How do I live knowing these things? Fortunately, there was a fourth sight on this journey, where there was a wandering holy person or ascetic common in that region, maybe Nepal, northern India region at the time. And this sight of this person who seemed kind of at peace. And he's like, that person might know some. All these other people look, you know, pretty unsettled running around. But this person looks like they know how to deal with this kind of disillusionment. And somehow this adolescent knew this. Like, there's something else here besides my ivory tower or my privilege. There's something else that is another way. And I know I can find it. And that kind of confidence and clarity is also kind of a theme of standing up in our lives and being open to what we know is true and right. Some people, it's too much for them. You know, people get lost in addiction, accumulation of more or less destructive tendencies, or try to buy their way with wealth out of sickness, old age, and death. So some people are too traumatized and don't figure out, don't connect to this deeper knowing. That's very sad. When we meet those people, it's very sad. And they can be dangerous. But that's a whole other story. So this intuition led this adolescent, not so much to a place of like, I have to escape this, but also like, how do I really show up in life? How do I really want to live? Maybe even live in a way that's beneficial. So there's a wholesome quality of feeling upset about the pain in the world. Like, oh, you know, when I was swimming in the Caribbean last year, I also felt tears and frustration to see the death of coral reefs. You know, and it impels me to practice even more. You know, so there is this theme, and something I quoted several times so far during this session, so I apologize for repeating myself. I'll probably, you know, these could be my last words in life, but it is from an ancient, fairly ancient teacher, Buddhist teacher, called Shantideva. And it says, the virtue of suffering, let's say disillusionment, has no rival. It's paramount. Since the shock it causes, from the shock it causes, intoxication falls away. This dream that I live in a palace only, my own little private Idaho. This intoxication with more, give me more. I just want to get another shot of dopamine, you know, falls away. And when that drops away, like that lotus, there arises compassion for everyone in this world of inevitable birth and death. There arises the lotus of a fear of doing harm. And there arises a longing for a path of life that's meaningful and caring and true and authentic, not polished. You know, it's muddy maybe. So this kind of profound disillusionment prompted a 6-year journey. So this young person, young, I guess 29 is an age that's given. Who knows? 29 would be old age maybe at that time, but you know, it's almost the right time for a quarter life crisis or a midlife crisis. But this Siddhartha spent 6 years, left the wealth and privilege behind and went wandering, trying to find, you know, checking in with the ascetics or the holy people or the teachers, great teachers, wise teachers of their time, you know, kind of dramatically cut off their long hair, kind of like if Howard took his ponytail and just cut it off, put on rag robes and left homes, left everything behind, went on pilgrimage to learn the way of the ascetics that somehow he intuited might help out with this situation of disillusionment and fear and anxiety and pain at the sadness in the world. Sidebar, I think, is that also the joy of the world, the immensity of the world, the beauty of trees can also be almost unbearable. So how do we live with all of this? So yesterday we kind of dipped into this Siddhartha's quest for peace, where he tries the general program for liberation practiced by the ascetics or the holy people of his time. And they were kind of extreme. They had a different view. First, he kind of went into learned these intense, deep meditative states, but it was almost dissociated. You know, you're so far removed, you're often the place with no form, no anything, you know. Didn't work. Once you came out of that state, which you always do, boink, back in reality. Then there was the grin and bear it approach, I call, the gnashing of teeth. You know, when you're so frustrated, you're like, ah. But he was like, this was some practice that was taught, teeth gnashing. Then there's breath control. Hold my breath, like, until my body is racked with whatever, hypoxia. Doesn't work, because if you hold your breath long enough, you actually pass out. And wake up again to sickness, old age, and death. Then let's try controlling eating. That's always a good thing to try. You know, anorexia. So, you know, if I just eat one sesame seed and a grain of rice per day, you will induce some weird states. You know, you can control, like any kind of, quote, addictive-like behavior, you can control your emotional states to some extent with deprivation, with self-mutilation, with, heroin, or eating one grain of rice and a sesame seed per day. Your mind, you begin to know what to expect from that. But then you wake up. You have two sesame seeds and you're back in suffering again. This is the way it goes. Your body adapts even to one sesame seed and you're conscious. So no dice here. 6 years of wandering, all these austerities and self-harm, self-beating. It's like the self-critic is super activated, you know, beating up every day. Still disturbed, unsettled by the reality of this world of birth and death, overwhelmed. So these practices of self-abuse and control and restraint did not produce sustainable peace. You know, in modern days, I think it's, you know, we have this capitalist structure that says if you just work hard enough, you know, if you just exercise enough, do more marathons, starve yourself, then you'll be perfect and liberated. Doesn't work. Sustainably. It's always a little trick, right? Something works a little bit, but it's not really effective. But that little bit makes you think it's like a lottery ticket. You know, it's like I have a 1 in a billion chance of this working, but it doesn't seem to work. So to simplify this story, I'll move on. So we'd pause there where Buddha said, my body state of extreme emaciation, my limbs became like the jointed segment of vine stems or bamboo stems because of eating so little. My ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. The gleam of my eyes sunk far down in their sockets, like the gleam of water sunk far down into a deep well. If I made water, that is, urinated, or evacuated my bowels, I fell over on my face there. I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, and the hair rotted, fell out at its roots because of eating so little. So this is, as I said, rock bottom. This, you know, face down in his own doo-doo. Then, kind of miraculously, in a daze, this bodhisattva had a loving, curious, and creative thought. Might there be another way? Might there be another way? So sometimes rock bottom leads us here. But, you know, when we're confronted with our own garbage, you know, left behind in a wake of our pleasure-grasping binges, you know, binges of distraction. No, let me binge a whole series of videos, or tirade binges, you know, at politicians or other people on the road, or at me for telling this story in such a cavalier way. But out of this came this beautiful idea. Maybe there's another way. If control is not the way, what is the way, bodhisattvas? So this memory was appearing in the midst of this situation. This childhood memory where Siddhartha meditates. And here's a little telling of it that is a little unique, but I really like it, from an old Mahayana sutra that recounts the life of Buddha. And it says, as Siddhartha meditates under the rose apple tree, another tree here, the power of his fierce meditation or samadhi is such that it generates an energetic field in the sky. This field disrupts the flight of five like holy men who are airborne, making their way to the Himalayas. So I guess, you know, some of these ascetics could fly, you know. I've actually seen some, doesn't TM teach that you can fly too? Yeah. I guess you can hop around enough on your cushion, you get off the ground a little bit. But they were grumpy. It said the grumpy holy people complain and are overheard by the goddess of this very rose apple tree, who, knowing the destiny of Siddhartha, that this one was destined for full-on awakening, explained to them what was going on and said, look, this is the Shakya prince, descendant of the best of kings, who shines like the dawn. His power, gained from the merit in millions of lives, is thwarting your flight. Thus chided, the holy men, together with the tree goddess, bowed down to the prince. So they were like, calm down. So there might be another way. And again, a tree helps out. And so we're at this energetic field under a tree between earth and sky. And I think that some people may have felt this, but during our session, this place where we are is that energetic field in this moment coursing this energy that we can't get a hold of, that we're all part of, unfolding moment by moment, breath by breath. This is sometimes called interbeing. I think the quality of that field is sometimes spoken or expressed as compassion or not knowing. This is the field of our zazen. So Buddha thought, pre-Buddha, let's say, thought, just sitting under a tree, could that be the path to awakening? And he kind of connected to what he always knew and said, yeah, I think that's the path. There was some confidence there. He also thought something really interesting, which is, why am I so afraid of that pleasure, which has nothing to do with sensuality, with grasping, with unskillful qualities? I thought, said the Buddha, I'm no longer afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with grasping and sensuality and other unskillful things. But that pleasure is not so easy to achieve with a body so extremely deprived and emaciated. You need nourishment. You know, sickness has entered this zendo, which is why most of us are masked. Our Kenzo, our cook, was stricken with some kind of cold. So we really miss him. But this did not stop our sesshin. So this Bodhisattva, Siddhartha, pre-Buddha, Buddha, gave himself permission to enjoy zazen. It's okay if you enjoy your practice. There's a nourishing kind of joy that's really different than an acquisitive joy. There's a joy that's not possessive and that's responsive, kind of like bamboo swaying in the wind. You know, it's got a solidity to it and a flexibility, but a responsivity. Our Tenzo's Dharma name is bamboo sound. So he's with us in some ways. And knowing this kind of joy leads us also, just like knowing the unsettling truth of suffering leads us to a liberative, liberated way of life that turns its back on nothing. So Buddha had to rely on his own confidence, affirmed by the earth and sky, had to have some nourishment, and now he's ready to sit down, nourished and protected by this tree, this banyan tree he decides to sit under, this beautiful tree. He sits supported by the earth, determined to awaken. So this very natural action of sitting down, and I quote it, and I'll just share this for those who haven't been here, something that was spoken at a sesshin by a teacher, a Japanese Zen teacher who taught in America named Kobunshino. Kobunshino says, zazen is the first formulation of the accomplishment of Buddha existing. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task holding this world, living in this world. We face such a big task. So naturally, such a person, such as you, who are all sitters, such a person sits down for a while. It's not an intended action, it's a natural action. So even if we look like we're doing something weird by sitting, it's really quite natural. But before sitting under this tree, before really attaining enlightenment, there was still some work to be done. You think, gosh, is it enough already, right? After all that, writhing on the ground, starving to death, you know, just let's set this person free. But no, there was more to come. A demon or a kind of Satan-like character, a Buddha Satan, you might say, brought an army of demons. So Buddha's sitting there under the tree. I'm going to sit here till I'm awake, completely at peace with this life that I can never know. And fear, threats, just armies of discomfort, threat to Buddha's family were brought on. Beautiful women to try to, you know, seduce him off his cushion in the form of these kind of sirens, you know, tempting him with the usual suspects of lust and greed and hate and confusion. That didn't work. How about offering some power? You could be president of the United States if you just get off that cushion. Or Elon Musk, you know, like you could be a super billionaire who is like just sitting here. Sat and sat and sat. I'll share something by a 20th century female teacher named Joko Beck, who said, intelligent practice always deals with just one thing, the fear at the base of human existence, the fear that I am not. And of course, I am not, but I would say, to elaborate, who I think I am is not who I am. That I alone am the world honored one is not springing from some logic or discursive thought. Joko Beck goes on to say, and of course I am not, but the last thing I want to know is that. I am impermanence itself in a rapidly changing human form that appears solid. I fear to see what I am. An ever-changing energy field. I don't want to be that. So good practice is about fear. Fear takes the form of constantly thinking, speculating, analyzing, fantasizing. With all that activity, we create a cloud cover to keep ourselves safe in a make-believe practice. I feel good, though, because everyone here is not in a make-believe practice. I can feel this and know it, if I know anything. But it's easy to get caught in a make-believe practice. So Joko goes on to say, true practice is not safe. It's anything but safe. But we don't like that. So we obsess with our feverish efforts to achieve our version of the personal dream. You know, somebody this morning came in to me and said, wow, driving here, it felt different. I said, how? Oh, it just felt like easier. Like I wasn't trying to get somewhere. I said, really? I said, yeah, this shit works. After 4 days of sesshin. And we wouldn't be here if we didn't know it. The only thing that matters is seeing with some kind of impersonal searchlight, seeing things as they are, says Joko. When the personal barrier, when all of our stuff all of that armor drops away. Why do we have to call it anything? It's just our lives. When we die, we die. No problem anywhere. So, in one last attempt, this Mara, Satan-like character, tried to induce self-doubt. Ha ha! You know, lust, all that stuff doesn't work. But self-doubt, that's pretty potent, right? It's sneaky, it's a kind of self-clinging, and it can look like humility. But it's clinging to a rigid, constructed self. So the Buddha's confidence in his own goodness, his own Buddha nature, his own worthiness and dignity was challenged. So who do you think you are sitting on that cushion, taking your place in this world? You don't deserve to be there. And then the story, I'll end the story. Thank you for listening. I'll end the story. The Buddha, like the Buddha on the altar, places their hand to the ground and calls upon the earth to witness and affirm the awakening. He doesn't let anybody else tell them who they are, what they are, how they should practice, what they're worthy of, but affirms. So the earth shakes, and the earth goddess affirms the Buddha's awakening. And then there's more to that story, but I'll end with Suzuki Roshi's comment on this story. It says, to find yourself as someone who is doing something is the point. To resume your actual being through practice, to resume the you, which is always with everything, with Buddha, which is fully supported by everything, right now. You say, you may say, that it is impossible, but it is possible. In one moment, you can do it. You can do it in one moment. Do you ever try something and like you're trying really hard, really hard, you can't do it, then all of a sudden you get that one time. Then you know, oh, maybe I can do that again. I can feel that connection and peace and sense of caring that isn't disturbed and knows how to respond to this world. And Suzuki Roshi says, even in one moment you can do it. It is possible in this moment. It is this moment. That's kind of amazing. You can do it in this moment. And if you have this confidence, this is your enlightenment experience. So no problem, bodhisattvas. We're always supported. And Zazen is like this trust fall into Indra's net, where we're jewels in this energetic field where we can't know. You know, Suzuki Roshi says, someone who is doing something. I don't even know who that's. Can't really grasp that someone or that something. It's just kind of arising. And in this falling, this trust falling, you know, we can delight in our jewel nature and appreciate the jewel nature of everyone and everything, no problem. So when we're affirmed by the earth and the sky in this field, you know how to care for the pain in your body. People have been doing this during Sesshin, and in the pains in your heart. We know how to care for this world. So maybe that's enough for me. I'm sorry to go on so long, but you know, when you do a 5-day Sesshin, something happens, and I wanted to bring everyone up to speed who hasn't been here, and I want to thank everyone for doing this practice together. Thank you all very much. We have some time for comments. Asian.
May I comment, because I'm going to have to leave.
Yeah, please.
You hit on the thing that I realized has been missing for me in the whole story about Buddha and his ascetic practices and then, you know, going and finding the middle way and sitting below the tree. I had always thought of, you know, all the things before he sits down and, you know, under the Bodhi tree as kind of, you know, mistakes. Like, that wasn't the way, and that wasn't the way, and that wasn't the way. But actually, if you want to end suffering, you have to really understand suffering. And ascetic practices will do that for you. You know, I mean, really, like, just the way that eating one sesame seed and one grain of rice is worse than not eating at all, because it gets your, you know, appetite and your metabolism all fired up and like, no, you know, just, so it's actually, I never really saw it this way, but this is our practice, is to really be with suffering and really get to know it, because you can't dismantle it if you don't know it, if you don't know what it is. And there seems to have been at least some doubt in Buddha's mind that he really knew suffering before he left home. But he sure did by the end.
And even when he thought he did, he got some more to work on.
Yeah.
So this intimacy, thank you so much. It's said it better than I ever could. Yeah. And Aishin has graciously filled in for our Tenzo, just like dropped herself into that role this morning. And this is the beauty of our practice, is people just, you know, you find your place where you are. Things change and we adjust to them. So thank you, Aishin, for...
But everybody is coming to support me. I've gotten lots and lots of support.
Yeah. Yeah. Even Adam showed up. Is Adam here?
Adam's upstairs.
Yeah, Adam. So a random bodhisattva showed up, got out of bed early, who never gets up before noon, said that he texted me last night and said, I want to come in to Sesshin today. I'm getting up at like 9 o'clock in the morning for the, you know. And I said, hey, if it works for you, great. But he's a great cook. He actually worked professionally as a cook. So he's helping Aishin and babysitting our lunch. So thank you, Aishin. I know
you're checking boxes up there.
Keep checking, bodhisattva. Keep checking. And Matthew also will be assisting in our nourishment preparations. Thank you. Anyone else? Howard Bodhisattva.
Hearing this story like 3 million times, it's always interesting hearing what sticks out for like the 3 millionth time. Right? Similar to Aishin, I was like, oh yeah, all these practices that he was doing, all these ascetic practices, and you know, even you look at those images, like the statues are like the emaciated, right? Literally skin and bones. And you go, oh well, that was the right way, right? That wasn't quite it. And I'm struck by just like, there's so much luxury, right, in the story. Like, I mean, not even just like quite literally, like, there's women everywhere, there's gold everywhere, right? Like, he has everything. Mm-hmm. But like, even the descriptions, right? Mm-hmm. All the stuff that happens, just what up. But like, you get to the actual like description of what he does under the tree, and it's the simplest thing ever. It is like annoyingly simple.
Yes.
Like, I remember I still feel this way, but for like years, I would be so annoyed reading descriptions of Zazen and like what Zazen practice is, because I'm like, what do you mean you just sit there? I don't like pay attention to my breath. I don't like meditate on an object. I don't visualize something. I don't do anything. Are you telling me I just sit here and look like an idiot? I'll just like twiddle my thumbs because I'm bored? Yeah. It's that fucking simple. And it's amazing watching what comes up when you have nothing to do. And you watch everything scramble, trying to fill in the space of something to do until it all just kind of slowly like settles like dust, like it's kicked up, right? But I think it never really stuck out to me until this time. Just like, there is no instruction in the, when he sits on the
chair.
There is no, yeah, then Buddha did these steps, right? That came afterward, right? And even those instructions are pretty simple.
Pretty simple.
But there is no instruction or even description of the kind of practice he does. He's just, he's sat.
Because we know how to live, actually, when we're in harmony with this field, right? Thank you. I see a golden hand from Dennis online, so let's thank you for that offering.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk. I got a lot from it. Could you talk a little bit about what the earth is affirming? Is it, you know, I get confused because of ego. And so is it Buddha being affirmed, Buddha nature being affirmed, or, you know, what is affirmed in that confidence? Thank you.
I think the confidence is affirmed, but I think, you know, there are many things. The simplest reading, right, would just be like, yeah, this is really Buddha. Like, this person attained this amazing thing. But actually, everything is affirmed with nothing missing. Every bit of our life, every tree branch, every sick person, and loss and gain is affirmed, verified, and honored, the dignity of everything, let's say. That's my off-the-cuff answer. I leave it to you to ponder endlessly, Dennis Moran. Thank you. Anastasia Bodhisattva.
I think the first time I heard that, the part of, about the earth, the touching of the earth, that the, I think it was a couple, maybe last year, Rohatsu, or maybe last year, and I was asking a question about similar to this, and I always, for myself, and I don't know what other people think, but I always sort of felt like, I have this sense, and obviously in my perspective, is that we, humanity, got lost somewhere. But the touching of the earth was, in some way, humanity coming back to something that it was disconnected from. And it's not, I guess I don't see it as an, maybe it is an affirmation of enlightenment, but is the enlightenment that, because someone who explained it last time was saying that when the touch of the earth happened, that everything became enlightened because the Buddha was enlightened or something of that nature. And I thought, well, could it be that the touching of the earth was actually the earth reconfirming that connection that was always there, but it wasn't like Buddha's thing made the birds realize that they were cool. The birds always knew they were cool.
Yeah.
It's just that now humanity was back online with everything. I don't know, I kind of like that read of it a little bit more, because it's like, I don't want humanity in another story to be one-upping everything else. And so I just sort of, that makes me happy. I was looking at the birds, the brave, cold birds outside, and realizing they die and all of that stuff, but do they suffer?
Yeah.
You know, maybe they just live.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the thing that Buddha was enlightened to. It's like life, just do that.
Absolutely. It's not like Buddha made everything awakened. Buddha just realized it, you know, and connected. The earth helped. And the sky helped too, actually. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the stories is that one of the first things Buddha said was, all the universe is entirely awakened, but due to our false conceptions and delusions, we don't see it or realize it. So he realized that, And he was like, that's good. And actually, you know, Buddha did not immediately teach. People had to cajole him into it. He was just kind of blissed out for a while on this, like, wow, I finally got something. And this is not like, Buddha wasn't so special because he got it. Maybe because actually people kept asking him, how do you get that, you know? But we all know this, and we forget it, and the earth connects us to it. So thank you for that, Anastasia. And thank you for, like, not letting Buddha one-up the rest of the world.
I just wanted to amend slightly, you know, it's not only that there were, that he was blissed out, but there was this period of not yet coming to the confidence which you've spoken of,
mm-hmm.
and this concern that it was more than he could convey. And
yeah.
then he continued to be, at that point, a little nudging.
Yeah, he was also like, oh, nobody else can get this. I won't be able to really help anyone. But, you know, it does take a while to, once it's like that shock of suffering, the shock of awakening. I'm like, wow, this is really how things were. And I didn't even realize it. I didn't realize what was going on, you know. Thank you, Earth and Sky, for grounding us. Anybody else? Eve Bodhisattva.
So to add on what Anastasia Loka was saying. Yes, when I sat down on that cushion, I saw the, I didn't know you'd been talking about trees. And I saw the tree out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And something in me was like, oh, tree consciousness, plant consciousness, that's not less than human consciousness. I want to honor that. But I thought it was interesting, and then when you start talking about trees, I'm like, did the thoughts sort of leave tracks in the room or something? Was there something I picked up on? I don't know.
We don't know. In a way that we can hold on to it, but we all know. So I'm getting maybe the eyeball from our Dohan that it might be time to wrap this show up for today. With this configuration, I want to thank everyone for joining us in the room, online, and in the universe. And we will complete this session this afternoon and keep going. Keep realizing, moment by moment, what can't be held, but what can only be cared for. That's what our job is. So thank you all very much. And I'm going to sign off from the people online so I can do my ending bows. And soon this technology will just read my mind, or I'll have some smart glasses that will make things look more seamless. But I'm happy being a little clumsy.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow. We bow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We bow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We bow to realize it.